Good morning. Today is extra credit. This is not on the final exam. But I hope it's helpful. You may need to interrupt me and ask questions, but I'll try. From the time of the Greeks up until Galileo, it was assumed by the philosophical scientific community that the speed of light was infinite. That is, it took no time at all for light to get from clear across the universe, and that was reasoned because space was empty. Light should travel instantaneously and get here. That was the prevailing scientific paradigm until Galileo, essentially. That's about 2,000 years. Now, and during this time period of 2,000 years, a lot of science and philosophy, our Western science comes out of its roots in Greek philosophy, as you probably know. We get our Western science pretty much with a little biblical addition. So you have a whole community insisting that the speed of light is infinite. And Galileo says, well, maybe it isn't infinite. I'll try to measure it. So he got some crew together with some lanterns and shutters and put them up on two hills a few miles apart. And he had an arrangement of signals for opening and closing the shutters so that you could measure how long it takes light to go from one place to another. Well, the experiment didn't work because the speed of light, it turns out, is not infinite, but it's very fast. 186,000 miles per second. 3 times 10 to the 8 kilometers per second, 1 foot per nanosecond. That's the electronics guys, a foot. Light travels that far in 1 billionth of a second. So it's really fast, okay? So Galileo gets everybody thinking, what if the speed of light isn't infinite? Now, that's a pretty radical, shocking thing. So everybody sets out to measure it. And the first guy that measured it successfully was a Danish astronomer named Rømer, who decided to look at the eclipse times of one of Jupiter's moons, the moon Io. Because when Jupiter's really close, you can look on a stopwatch and see when this little moon goes back behind the backside of Jupiter, and you write the time down. Now, Jupiter moves way around out in its orbit. It's way, way far on the other side of the sun. And you take a telescope and watch and see, does the moon disappear behind the planet at the same time? Well, no, it doesn't. It comes some 20 minutes later. Aha! Well, the moon's still doing its thing at the same speed around the planet. But now that Jupiter's way far away, so it's taken 28 minutes for the light to get here from the far side. So now we have an idea of the velocity of light. Some rough idea. Nobody believed that. 25, 30 years went by and everybody said, oh, this is not true. And then a guy named Bradley measured it by an English astronomer by a totally different method, light aberration method. And he came to the conclusion that light traveled at about 186,000 miles an hour is not so fast. Well, you get gradually over 50 years, you get the scientific community coming around to the idea that the velocity of light is not infinite, but it's constant, and they decided that the constant's about 186,000 miles a second. That's the little bit of history. Well, now, 300 years have gone by, and the velocity of light has been measured by 16 different methods, by all sorts of very competent people. The earlier measurements would be a little cruder, but still very careful. And the more recent measurements are very, very accurate and very careful. And all this gets published. And down through the course of time, various people have said, well, I wonder if the speed of light is really a fixed constant, or I wonder if it's changed in the last 300 years. So that question has been asked on and off. Well, Einstein sort of assumed, and it's about 1912 or so, right in there, in developing his theory of relativity and figuring out what C is all about, why it's important, he decided that C was probably constant, and he was going to use that in his work. It's kind of an assumption. It's not in the law of Moses that requires C to be constant, but that's a working assumption. Well, that's the assumption that has been held all the way down until the present. Well, in 1967, because there are a whole bunch of measurements of C, C was defined to be a constant. So it's not allowed to change. You pick a number, and that's the standard number. Now, my friend Barry Sutterfield, 25 years ago, assuming that the speed of light was a fixed constant, decided to look at all the measurements. that had ever been made and published, and you can pick out maybe 150, 60 good measurements. And he noticed that if you measured the speed of light over 300 years, it was every single measurement that was later was a slower velocity. Not much, but enough to be important. Every single subsequent measurement was a lower value. Well, that's if the speed of light's not a constant, this is a huge, huge deal, big deal. It's not a trivial thing. It's supposed to be absolutely, totally constant. I got to know Barry 25 years ago or so by mail, regular snail mail, and then later by email, and now in person. And so he and I have been good friends. That's his chart over there on the wall, and I have some of his notes, and he has a website and all that sort of thing. Well, Barry is an astronomer, physicist, and so he's began to gather all the measurements of C and wrote a paper in 1987. Almost got me fired from my job because he and I published this research paper as a kind of a white paper that was just that we were immediately attacked by some of the creationists of all people, not by the secular scientists, but the creationists were very threatened by this. I don't know why. That continues. That's the story to this present day. I have a good friend in Canada who's a statistician, and he and I decided, well, let's do our own independent measurements, our own independent analysis. And so we got all the data we could find on the velocity of light and compiled it all together and selected it. Spent a whole year. Now, this is emailing Excel files back and forth to Canada. They go across the border real easy. And, we finally got a paper published in a journal called Galilean Electrodynamics, in which we showed that from a statistical point of view, there's a 95% certainty that the velocity of light has dropped in the last 300 years. In other words, it's far more accurate to say the speed of light is not a constant than to say that it's constant. The other thing we did was we looked at all of the other constants that have time in them, either time or 1 over time. The speed of light has 1 over time in it. It's feet per second. It's a time in it. We found that all the constants that had time in them were changing. Matter of fact, Planck's constant is increasing over time in direct proportion to the way that C is decreasing over time. Well, that's interesting. Then we found that there were some constants that really are constant, and as far as all the measurements say, they've never changed. So that gives you some confidence that this universe is stable. Rydberg's constant there's all the constants that don't have time in them. Now, why is this important? Well, first of all, light. Einstein was the one that came up with the model that light can be thought of as either wave or particle. Light includes not only visible light, which is just a narrow part of the spectrum, but X-rays and gamma rays and infrared rays are all light, radio waves. This room is filled with photons or waves from 1,000 radio stations right now, all just permeating here, and those are all electromagnetic waves, or if you want, they're photons. And so we've got this dual model of what light is, and it turns out it's all terribly important. Everybody agrees that the velocity of light is what it is. In empty space, now we all know, it's well known that when light enters water, it slows down in water. You can show that from a refraction experiment real easy. And it slows down in air a little tiny bit, and it slows down in glass, so we have refraction and all these things. So the speed of light depends on the medium in which it's traveling. Depends on the medium. Well, now, empty space is supposed to be empty. It's supposed to be empty. So you should be able to throw a photon across empty space and have it get there right away. It shouldn't slow down. Nothing should slow down. Well, it turns out that the empty space isn't empty. Either in either model, either for photons or for waves. If you send a wave out through empty space, it turns out that the wave has a velocity that suggests that empty space has two properties. It has inertia and it has elasticity. This is how the speed of any wave has always got inertia and elasticity. Inertia is mass or resistance to change. Elasticity is springiness. Well, empty space has these two properties, but they're unlike any known medium that we know about. We don't know what It's weird stuff. I called it, on day two of Creation Week, I discussed this as the firmament, which God stretched out very thin on day two of Creation Week, and that I described as the stretching out of empty space. Okay, and then I pointed out that empty space isn't empty, and maybe we should get back to that in a minute. But now, why is it that C is the special constant that it is? What is so special about it? Well, it turns out that it occurs in all kinds of equations in physics that are everyday equations. E equals mc squared. That's an Einstein equation. Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Now, let's just take that one equation. If C is not a constant, then we got a big problem. If we want, one of the sacred principles in physics is conservation of energy. Energy is always conserved. So if E is constant and C is changing, then M is changing. Then mass should be changing. Well, then you look and say, well, you can't have that because we're not getting heavier or lighter or anything that's... Are you getting heavier? Oh, yeah, well, that's related to one of the other constants. The donut. That's a difference. That's a... Yeah.
At one time you said the universe was expanding.
It was expanded on day two to a maximum fixed diameter. And I'll come back to that. I'll come back around to that, to day two.
Well, would that affect the speed of light?
Yes. Yes, I'll come back to that. Now then, I want to take E equals mc squared, and I've suggested that C is not a constant, and therefore M is changing. Well, it turns out the M in that equation is not ordinary mass. It's atomic mass. It's mass inside the atom. Now, that means that things going on inside the atom are affected by changes in C, but things out in the ordinary real world are not affected very much by C. Now, that's a big one. That's a huge, huge radical idea, that things going on inside the atom run on a different clock. That means that if the speed of light was faster in the past, that electrons went around the nucleus faster. That means that vibrations in the nucleus were faster. It means that atomic mass was greater inside the nucleus, but not outside. That means that you could have the speed of light could change over an enormous range and it wouldn't affect your daily life. Well, it may affect some biological processes a little bit because there are electrical things going on inside your body. But for ordinary purposes, you see, the thing that we have to do right now is if you say the speed of light is not a constant, then you've got to find out if that's practical. I mean, would the universe blow up? What's going to change? What's stable? Well, all right, now we've got one problem solved, is it appears that atomic masses change, but macroscopic mass doesn't change.
When you were looking at the constants, particularly the primary electric ones,
there are two clocks in the universe, two known scientific clocks. One would be Newton's clock, and we had that clock on day four of Creation Week. The motion of the sun, moon, and stars is the time clock that God uses to tell us history in the Bible. That means the rotation of the earth on its axis once is one day. It takes a month for the moon to go around the earth. It takes a year for the earth to go around the sun. That's called dynamical time. As far as we know, over the whole history of the 8,000-year universe we live in, dynamical time hasn't changed very much. The Earth is probably still rotates about once every 24 hours in that clock. So you can trust the Bible as giving you a time scale that hasn't ever changed very much. Now, the atomic clock is another matter. The atomic clock is ticking at a different rate. And in the atomic clock, now, for example, there are some heavier nuclei that are unstable, and they decay spontaneously all the time. They emit particles. And we measure the rate at which particles are coming out of radioactive uranium or whatever it is, and we have a dating clock that's based on the rate of the disintegration and transmutation of the elements by radioactive decay. That's a whole different clock. If the speed of light's not a constant, all the constants, all the numbers that tell you about the atomic clock have C in them. the long and short of this is that the atomic clock is running in proportion to C, and the dynamical clock is not. Well, now, in the last 300 years, the speed of light hasn't changed very much. It's only changed a percent or two. But now, I wish we had more data from 500 years ago so we could pin this down. But we have a lot of indirect reason to believe that over the history of the universe, the speed of light changed a lot. Calculate it, for example. Several different methods now. How much did the speed of light change since creation? Well, it turns out the total change is of the order of 10 billion or 100 billion times. A factor that much. But 1 foot per nanosecond right now, 10 billion or 100 billion times faster at creation. Atomic clock running around at an enormously fast rate, giving you enormously old ages, giving you many, many millions of years for events that happened a few thousand years ago. Okay. Oh, young universe. Very good. Now, it's true that the earlier measurements were not as accurate as the later measurements, but that turns out not to affect the conclusion about the changing speed of light. Turns out the speed of light, we have a curve now. We know that the speed of light dropped very sharply early in the history of the universe, and that right now, in the last 30, 40 years, it's changing very, very slowly. And we have a few measurements by comparing a couple of measurements where you compare the atomic clock and the dynamical clock, see if there's any drift between them, and there is. There's a small drift. You wouldn't notice it because the speed of light was defined to be constant. The speed of light's not changing very much right now. It's the tail end of a long curve. Now, why is this so? Now we go back to day two of creation week. We have got some other problems in physics that have to be explained, one of which would be the red shift. The red shift was noted back in the 20s, and Edwin Hubble made this all famous, because the light from distant stars is shifted toward the red spectrum. The whole spectrum is red shifted. And so the further you go out in space, the redder is the light coming in. And from that, you can actually generate a curve of red shift versus distance. And from that, you can calibrate the age of the universe in atomic time to billions of years, if you want, by this red shift curve. And it's assumed in the redshift that the universe, one way to explain the redshift is a Doppler kind of thing, where the universe is a big balloon that's expanding rapidly. And so the galaxies far out are expanding very, very rapidly, and so the light is shifted toward the red. Now, that's been the prevailing paradigm since 1930 or so, quite a while. And that's the dyed-in-the-wool standard scientific view that you'll hear on TV all the time, that's now proven scientific fact. But it's not proven scientific fact. Science always proves itself wrong and then takes a step forward. So there's other ways to explain the red shift, which is why when we were back in the early in chapter 1 of Genesis and discussed day 2 of creation week, on day 2, God made a firmament in the midst of the waters. And I don't know what a firmament is. He made it. And it was ultra dense. And then it says he stretched out this firmament and he pushed the waters above and pushed the waters below. So 20 times in the Old Testament you have this heavens being stretched out in Isaiah and in the Psalms and in Genesis. The whole idea of God stretched out the heavens like a tent. Is that familiar to you? Well, what's being stretched out? Well, this substance called the firmament is being stretched out. Well, what in the world is the firmament? I don't have a piece of it here. Because it's all been stretched out so thin right now that it appears to be empty space. But it's not empty space because light has a finite speed. Now, what happens? This is an elastic medium. So we take this little bundle of firmament and stretch it out. And to stretch it out, you have to put a lot of energy in it. You have to pump it full of energy. God did that. He hurdles it out, stretches it. It's full of energy. Well, what's going to happen to that? Where does that all that energy go? At the same time, the speed of light is pushed way up to a very high value. And then you leave it stretched out. Leave the universe stretched out, maximum diameter, day 2. It's finished. All done. No more stretching out of the universe. Well, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to sit there like an elastic medium, and it's going to relax. And as it relaxes, down comes the velocity of light by this huge factor, okay? Now we have to get a little bit more complicated, because now there's a whole new branch of physics that's called ZPE, zero point energy. Yeah. And this is pretty fancy stuff. And I don't understand myself. I have to make up an explanation for it. But that's what your professors do for you anyway, so. If you try to make a perfect vacuum, let's take a jar and pump all the air out of it. We get all the molecules of air out of there, so you think there's a vacuum. But as I mentioned once before in here, if you have an empty jar that's supposed to be a vacuum, there's nevertheless a lot of photons still going through it. Light waves and radio waves are going through there, and they all have energy. And so there's actually a certain amount of energy in this bell jar that's pumped out. So the next thing I do is I freeze it. I put it down and get it as cold as I possibly can. I get it down to absolute zero so that if there's any residual thing going on in there, it'll stop. Then what you find out is when you've done that, you still have some residual energy in that bell jar, and it's called the zero point energy. Now comes the interesting thing. So maybe the vacuum, see, down through the whole history of science, ideas about the vacuum have changed. There was the Greeks had the idea that the vacuum was a whole bunch of super dense particles that all were colliding one another, that the vacuum was a solid and particle, and then you come to the vacuum as an empty space, and you come back, now we're coming around to that vacuum is full. It's seething with energy. That's the term, seething. Do you like that? It's a seething foam of virtual particles. How's that sound? Virtual not meaning imaginary. It's a reservoir of vast amounts of energy there that averages to zero. It averages to the zero point energy. Related to that's Planck's constant. Planck's constant was small when the velocity of light was large, and this is all tied in with the behavior of empty space. Now, this helps you with some things in physics, one of which, for example, is electrons rotate around the nuclei of all atoms in the universe, right? But a radiated charge, a rotating accelerated charge should radiate its energy. An electron should only go around the nucleus two or three times, and it should have radiated all its energy away, and it should collapse. Well, it doesn't. And your physics professor will say, well, we don't know why the electron doesn't collapse. It's just the way it is. But the zero-point energy guys say, oh, well, no, there's a lot of energy coming in from the vacuum that's being pumped into the electrons that keeps them from collapsing, so they're being resupplied with energy all the time. Well, I like that, because that's sort of a little bit like Colossians 1, that in Christ all things cohere, that God holds the whole universe together. For God to be putting a lot of energy into the universe to keep it stable, that's fine. If he let go, it'd all vanish. That's all. I like that. That's kind of better than having the absent landlord type God. You know, I'd rather have him running the nucleus. Well, now, it turns out the amount of energy coming out of the vacuum is huge. It's humongous. That means that one little cubic centimeter of empty space has got zillions megawatts, gigawatts. It's got an enormous amount of energy. I know some scientific groups that are trying to extract the energy out of the vacuum. They're crazy, but they might do it. In which case, you've got free power. Because the whole idea is that the vacuum is as if it's like a sea of particles that appear and disappear. And so their average lifetime is very, very small, related to Planck's constant. So they don't last very long, and they cancel each other out. So the average is very, very low, but the amount of potential energy in there is huge. Now, then, if you think of the vacuum as being a sea of particles, virtual particles, and you put a photon through that sea, then if there are more virtual particles, the photon's going to encounter more collisions as it goes along. It's going to be absorbed and re-emitted. That's what happens when a photon enters glass. It gets absorbed and re-emitted and absorbed and re-emitted, and it takes time for this to happen. Well, the same thing happens in empty space. That photons get absorbed and re-emitted, and that's why the velocity of light is what it is. Well, now, the zero-point energy appears to be increasing over time. means more virtual particles, means more collisions, means the speed of light's dropping down, means that this gets pretty non-intuitive now, okay? Is that term non-intuitive all right here? This is what's happened now. When we first published this, when Barry first published this, 1987, when we first published our stuff, we got, of course, in enormous hot water with people who were in denial about all this and still are. And a lot of the problem from the traditional creationists who want a literal King James Version and a literal 4004 B.C. creation, and they don't like change. These Christians are harder to change than the secularists are, it turns out. In the last two or three years, there have been a lot of papers now from secular scientists suggesting the speed of light is not a constant and proposing their own reasons why that should be so. I mentioned Setterfield, and I think he's right. He suggests the speed of light's changed by 10 billion, 11 billion times. There's another guy that's decided it's changed by 60 orders of magnitude. That's humongous. Then there's a Paul Davies, the Australian scientist, thinks it's changed a little bit. He thinks the fine structure constant. Everybody wants on the bandwagon now. All the secular scientists would like to be the first to get the Nobel Prize. Well, now, ideas this radical, you got to wait about 50 years before they get to be generally accepted, because there's a lot of professors making big bucks and selling their books and having credentials and sitting on the faculties of big universities, and their books teach the old view, and so they're not about to take anything that's heresy like this because it threatens their livelihood. And the academic credentials of the university are up in the air. So you have to wait a while until you get some brave graduate students that start dissenting with their professors and going out on their own, and old retired people like me that don't have jobs to lose. So I think that with confidence, and I think the next few years it will be generally established that the speed of light is not a fixed constant. Then there will be all kinds of discussions about how much it's changed and thoughts about why, and then all these enormous consequences in physics. The constant C is in all sorts of equations, all kinds of equations, radioactive decay and everywhere. So you got to go and look at all equations in physics with the idea that C is not a fixed constant, see what changes and see what does. So you could write a whole bunch of PhD theses if you want on this. It's a wide open field. The most interesting thing has to do with the fact that you can now pretty well reconcile the great geological ages of the Earth with biblical dates. And I've suggested the universe is not 4,000 B.C., but 8,000 B.C. Barry Setterfield's chart over there, if you look at the geological record, it's a bunch of realistic, reasonable observations by careful geologists over the years. If you look at the fossils, where they are, what kind of fossils they are, you look at all the sediment layers and all the volcanism and all these things, you've got, there's a huge amount of data in the geologic column and in the fossil record that you have to somehow, that has to be consistent with biblical truth. We're headed for the same truth, you know. Science is not anti-truth. It's supposed to be the pursuit of truth. So this is what Setterfield has been doing recently. That's what that great chart is all about over there. Barry proposes that there have been several catastrophes, the first of which would be the Great Flood of Noah. And the date in atomic time is 678 million years ago, I forget. And I'm suggesting that in real years was 3500 B.C., approximately. At which point there is a deluge and everything that's on Earth that's alive is buried. That would mean these vast forests were buried and all the vegetation and lots of all kinds of green growing things. And maybe that's the time you lay down a lot of coal beds and you certainly get a whole mass extinction of life and it's buried in the flood. Well, that doesn't explain everything. Now you've got the recovery period, which we're just about to get to soon. The Earth begins to rebound from the flood. Well, are there some other catastrophes? Well, there appear to be. It appears to be that the recovery from the flood is going to last some hundreds of years, probably 600-700 years of recovery, during which there is going to be a volcanism, a lot of volcanic activity, a couple of asteroid impacts that trigger these things. A continental drift, the continents splitting all apart, the Earth flipping a little bit on its axis, some violence in the weather patterns, some subsequent disasters, one of which probably seems to be about the time of the Tower of Babel, and another one a couple hundred years later, at which we'll get to on Peleg, at the days of Peleg, when it appears that the continent split up. Now, if you go back to the fact that radioactive decay is proportional to velocity of light, and you go to a time in the past when the universe had a very high velocity of light, that would be before the flood, what this means is that all the atomic elements that decay quickly would have decayed very, very quickly. These atomic elements turned out mostly to be down in the mantle of the Earth right now, present time, and if you were to switch on radioactive decay, you start heating up the interior of the Earth very quickly. Very, very quickly. You may have heated it enough, it may have heated the interior of the Earth enough that actually it melted the interior and the iron went down to the core. That's possible. At any rate, you can imagine the Earth's crust heating very, very much. In fact, the radioactivity is in the crust pretty much still today. Heating the crust so much that the water trapped down in the crust eventually comes to the point where it explodes. And producing the fountains of the Great Deep in the week of the flood, and probably triggered by an asteroid coming crashing in. Because if the interior of the Earth is heating up by radioactive decay, so also is the interior of the planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and there appears to have been a planet out between Mars and Jupiter where the asteroid belt was, and it appears to have had a moon around it, and it appears to have blown up, bombarding all the planets in the universe with asteroids and cratering the moon and doing all these things. And I expect that event may have fractured the crust of the Earth enough to let this trapped hot water come welling up and producing the torrential rains of the flood and just suggestion. Well, that's not all. The radioactive decay is going to continue to heat up the interior of the Earth, so we're going to get volcanic activity, plenty of evidence of volcanism, lots of stuff going on the other planets, on Mars and Venus and on the Moon. It's the same physics everywhere, same processes in nature going on, so this isn't just a local thing here on the Earth. We're going to get, if the interior of the Earth heats up a lot, then right under the crust it's going to get very slippery. And that means that you can take the continents, you can move them around as if they were floating on hot molten rock. It's pretty easy to move the continents around to their present configuration. Now you move all the continents around, you move the oceans around, flip the Earth a little on its axis. Pretty soon we're going to have seasons and some violent things. Some species can adapt and some can't. So this period of time from the flood, 3500 BC down to maybe 2800 BC, is going to be a time of violent catastrophe everywhere, and an ice age in there someplace. I think there's no question there was an ice age, probably about the time that Job lived, or a little bit like that. Job's early. Maybe we'll get to Job a little bit in here. Now, that's the general idea. If you want to read, there's a technical paper. I've got a few copies of back there that goes into this in some detail. All of this is on my website. It's all on Centerfield's website. Those of us who work with everyday physics, and my physics is 50 years old, so it's pretty out of date, but it's easy to talk about it and to kind of understand it, but for you, I realize it's probably in Greek or something coming out in a foreign tongue and needs to be interpreted. But where did I leave you at this? Who's hopelessly lost? Well, no, the carbon dating, the half-life of radioactive carbon 14 is short. So I forget what the half-life is. 1,500 years? 1,200 years? Not very long. So you can't use carbon, and that clock would also have slowed down.
Yeah.
So even carbon dating would give you 20,000 years when it was really much less than that. Well, now we use potassium-argon dating and things like that to get these very, very long ages. All those clocks are slowing down, all of them.
Is there any recognition?
Yeah, there's a bunch of creationists in San Diego at ICR have a whole committee called the RATE Committee, R-A-T, Radioactive Time something. And they're spending huge amounts of money to figure out why this is so. Why one of the assumptions always was that radioactive decay rates are constant. That's always been an assumption. But we haven't measured radioactive decay for very long. We don't hardly have any data on it. So that's an assumption. You always make these assumptions. They're all uniform, uniformitarian, you know. If the speed of light has a certain value today, then it's always had that value. If radioactive decay is going this fast, then it's always gone that fast. If conditions favorable for life exist now, they've always existed that way. See, this taking up 50 years, 100 years worth of measurement and trying to move back to the origin of the universe, that's flawed. It's flawed biblically and it's flawed scientifically. Chris, we've got a genuine physicist there in fact. Well, I'm sorry, we can give you some help. And oh, gosh. Oh. I'm sorry to hear that. You can't, throw out the data. And fresh basalt, fresh lava dates very old. It is. That's exactly right. You take the data that agrees with the prevailing paradigm and you throw away these anomalies that don't agree with it and arbitrarily throw them out. They couldn't possibly be true. That's right. And then see the underlying assumptions. We live in an old universe, therefore we'll only look for data that supports that. We know the Big Bang happened, so... Yes. Nobody was there. There was nobody there. So where do we get an accurate record, the best accurate record of the early history of the world? Can we trust the Bible? Well, it's frustrating for those of us who grew up in Western civilization with scientific analytical minds when we find out the Bible's all about redemption and not a lot of science in there. There's tantalizing enough science to give us, I think, a pretty good model. But as I mentioned last week, I don't care whether the universe is old or young. I care about the continuity from Adam to Jesus, the thread of human redemption matters. And I certainly want my biblical worldview to be as consistent as I can with what I see from science. Eventually, we're going to get to heaven and we're going to have science that agrees with the Bible, and we'll all be amazed at both sides of this. Yeah. No, the speed of light drops enormously during the years before the flood, and it's over on the Barry's chart. It drops really quickly. Barry thinks that radioactive decay was there from the beginning of creation. I don't. I think that God switched on radioactive decay when the angels fell. That's my pet thought. Once you switch on the radioactive decay, then it's going to run inversely proportional to C. I think it was turned on as a consequence of the angels losing their control over the physical universe. So we have another problem. We have the curse on creation, whatever that means. The curse on creation makes things, damages the physical universe. So we have some discontinuities in the laws of physics when man falls. We have some discontinuities when the angels fall. I don't know how to sort these things out. The second law of thermodynamics, the tendency of the universe to run down decay, it was switched on by this, by sin. Death is in the world because of sin. So we can't talk about a universe that has that's perfect. It's flawed. It's damaged, and there's been damage at several points along the line. Radioactive decay occurs when you have too many protons in the nucleus, basically, and lots of neutrons with them, and there's not enough binding energy to keep it stable, so it wants to split up. The reason that atoms don't explode with all the positive charges in the nucleus is because of there's a potential well there, or the what's called the nuclear binding energy is one of the basic forces in physics. It may simply be related to the way that protons are lined up in opposite spins or something, but all you've got to do is decrease the nuclear binding energy a little bit, and you would take atoms that were once stable and they would now become unstable. So I would tend to think that all the atoms in the universe were originally stable, and that radioactive decay is, I don't think radioactive decay is one of the beneficial things of the creation. I think it's destructive. Right now you've got cosmic rays raining down through your body, and they're coming in several per second right now. And every once in a while, a cosmic ray will damage some of your genetic tissue. And we've got damaged genes, mostly from cosmic rays and from the radioactive elements that are in the Earth's crust. And I see those as consequences of evil, not features of the natural universe. That's my opinion. This whole way of talking about things is very, there aren't very many people doing this. Barry is a very, very godly man and very careful, and he's devoted 30 years to this. And I'd like to have him come here maybe and give a lecture on a Saturday morning or a Sunday night, so you could all ask him the questions and see his model. He's a very marvelous man to talk to, very humble. And he married a friend of mine, Helen Fryman, and neither of these dear people ever had a happy marriage. Barry was never married, and he's just now married at age 60 and happy, and the two of them are working a lot. She's a very good apologist. Anyhow, I'd like to maybe get Barry down here for a special seminar, and then we get more of his videos and charts and so on. Now, we got a lot of questions.
Yeah, time used to go faster long ago.
Atomic time.
Oh, only atomic time.
Yeah, not dynamical time.
So does this have anything to say about why people live longer then?
No. As far as we know, and we'll get to that later on in Genesis. As far as I know, we can't seem to find any causal reason for the human lifespan to drop from 900 and some years down to the present 70. It drops down in a pretty smooth curve. But I don't know what mechanism in biology is going in. It seems to be unrelated to the speed of light. God caused it, but I've never seen anybody give an explanation. So I don't know. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mantle.
You're saying that radioactive decay is causing the nucleus to heat up? If it's heating up, it's
expanding. What? Causing the Earth to heat up, the crust of the Earth.
So why wouldn't the core heat up? Why wouldn't the core expand also and cause the mantle?
The radioactive elements seem to have been near the crust, within 1,000 kilometers of the surface, right from the beginning. Did God put them all these heavy elements up in the crust to start with, or was there something earlier that got them up? But they are in the crust. If you go down in a mine, the temperature rises. A 5,000-foot deep mine is almost unbearably hot. They have to air condition them. And that heating coming up from the Earth is from radioactive decay going on right now. Most of it is. Although the very center of the Earth is also hot. It's hot because of the pressure. And it's also, as you say, there is a core of iron. You know this from seismic waves. And so the Earth may have melted down inside at one point in time and overturned and layered itself. Now, the volcanism that's everywhere, that seems to be, I think, late, seems to be post-flood volcanism, also by radioactive heating. So I wouldn't put all the volcanism either at creation or at the time of the flood, but later. Yeah, and that's a little iffy. No, it's iffy that they even exist at all, because Walt Brown discusses the whole the unreasonable nature of plates that far down deep in the earth squeezing against each other and subducting. And it would make sense if this material was less viscous than it is now, but it's too brittle now, and it's too deep for this to be very realistic. So the whole thing about continental drift right now is going on at the rate of centimeters per year. And I think that when the continent split apart, it was probably a matter of months or so. It was rather quick. And if you put this at the time of the Tower of Babel, then you get the human race begins to be dispersed. You only have to lower the sea level about 300 feet and you would connect all the continents right now by land bridges. So that's kind of interesting little. Yes, sir.
I would like to ask you about the Bible. How old is the Bible? When he got I asked for the Bible, how old is it? And mm-hmm. I wonder how old it is for the Bible.
The Bible. If we say, I think Job is the oldest book in the Bible, and we'll, if we get time, we'll talk about the last chapters of Job, which will demolish everything that I've taught you the last weeks totally. But these first five books are Moses, so that would be about 1500 B.C. that this was all written down. And I'm talking then about a creation in like 6000 B.C., a flood in 3500 B.C. So Moses is writing these things down long after the creation. So this is one of the reasons I'd like to think that he had some records to go by. And I'd love to catch Noah's laptop computer. It would be a Macintosh, but I'd... Phil?
I did a lot of radioactive decantation
Yep. If you switch on radioactivity, then I think you begin to get isotopes immediately, and with the atomic clock running faster, you'll get them very quickly, and the short-lived ones will be long since gone forever, and the longer-lived ones will still be being produced today. Well, Barry would say there were, and I'd say there weren't, and we're just having we don't. You know, just kind of an opinion. Yeah, Peter.
I remember reading that chlorine comes in two major isotopes, and normally the chlorine isotope is 99.9% of one kind. Well, chlorine is 75% of one kind, 25% of the other kind.
Mm-hmm.
And those probabilities, those percentages are quite
interesting.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you have to assume that the
chlorine
was formed by radioactive decay. Both isotopes,
either
both isotopes were formed.
Yeah, yeah. Or, it's some sort of fusion process. Yes, that's right. I think that's true. Bill can talk to you after the class and tell you all about that, I think.
You don't play fair.
No. Because I don't know very much. I know less than I used to. In the back. Yes. Yes. Yeah, you can sort the data by error bar size, by decade, by measurement, and the conclusion is the speed of light is not a constant. It doesn't matter how you sort the data. So that's, fortunately, the trend is greater than the error bar size.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you the very last page of that technical report is a curve, which happens to be the same as the redshift curve. The technical report, which there's only a few copies of it. It's not in today's notes, but in the back.
There's a premise that the phosphorus around the temple was fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
That something took it loose.
Yep.
The Mediterranean went into the Black Sea.
Yeah.
Is that the same as Noah's?
No, it couldn't. No, but it could. If there now there's that's disputed because it's not sure which way the flood was going, whether it was going in or out. But it would have happened subsequent to Noah's flood. It would have been happened probably as a consequence of the ice age. As we have inland after the ice age, we have all these big inland seas like the Great Salt Lake and the Sacramento Valley, all full of sediments. And those big inland seas would be a result of the ice age, which was going to maybe say be 500-600 years after the flood, I think. That'd be my opinion. Yeah. Well, this is now I forgot something here. One of the peculiar things about the speed of light is it has not changed continuously. It has changed in quantum jumps. The speed of light is going along like this, and then suddenly all through the whole universe all at once it jumps down to a lower value, and then it goes on and then it jumps. And you can actually go to a galaxy and find that part of the galaxy is emitting light at the higher speed, and then the other part of the galaxy, the speed of light has jumped down one increment. And so the speed of light has gone in quantum jumps. Now that is a real problem for a Big Bang theory. It's a big problem for everything except the ZPE stuff. The quantum zero-point energy people say, oh, this is exactly what we'd expect. So they're happy with that, naturally. Yeah. Well, yeah. Of course, we're building bigger telescopes to see as far as we can. There's another couple of other little neat things in all this. It appears that at the center of every galaxy is a quasar. It appears also that if you, in the vacuum theory, if you stretch out the firmament, you get a lot of vortices, energetic vortices. And if you've got quasars in them, you've got the energy source that can spin off the stars on the fourth day of creation. These quasars have enormous amounts of energy in them. The speed of light would originally have been so fast that we could go to the corners of the universe in no time at all. The other interesting thing that goes along with this is there's a maverick named Tom Van Flandern who's decided that the speed of gravity is as high as light once was. The speed of gravity is 10 billion times the speed of light. So that's very interesting. So the speed of light's not the top limiting velocity in the universe. That means that people now have to do their science fiction over again. Yeah.
What I was going to say about the GMT curve is where was it in relation to the flood? I was wondering if the before the flood was very high, then it means that background radiation
is. Well, except that if the radioactive elements are down in the crust, they won't get up to the surface and hurt any damage any people. They'd just be heating up the subterranean chambers. So the water coming up out of the fountains of the deep may have been scalding hot super pressure water going up in the atmosphere and getting hot rain for 40 days. Well, I think that paper, there's such brief comments on the other planets and there by Barry that... Yeah, except that there seems to be no correlation. I haven't seen any explanation for the. I'll bring in the curve of the. In fact, I already gave it to you. I think it's some notes of the longevity after the flood. It does drop, but biologically, I don't know why. Somebody will find out why. Anybody who knows about death and dying could probably tell us what's going on in cells and why we don't live 900 years anymore. But I don't, I've never read anything on that. Well, this is totally confusing to everybody, I can see, probably. Me too. Yeah. Look how weird and wonderful is this science that maybe I think leading edge that 50 years from now will be obsolete and it'll be out of fashion and somebody will have something new, but the Bible's totally trustworthy. Totally, I think. Well, the heavier particles come out at certain finite velocities. The photons all come, gamma rays and X-rays come out at the speed of light. Oh. Well, that's called entanglement. And that's another something weird and wonderful, that if you take two photons, two electrons that have the same spin, and you move them way far apart, and then you flip one over, the other one flips over immediately, and they're very far apart. And how do they talk to each other? Instantly. Well, they appear to flip at exactly the same instant over a vast distance. So that's called entanglement. That's a whole other subject. But then on the other hand, now the vacuum, I think, is the interface to the spiritual realm. So I think that the vacuum is the invisible boundary layer that separates us from the heavens, from the invisible world of the heavens. And God's putting energy in through the vacuum all the time. Vacuum's all around us and in us and through us.
You were differentiating atomic mass from our ordinary macroscopic mass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where does our macroscopic mass come from if not from atoms?
It comes from, now that this is a whole other big can of worms, because there's... But because what gravity is now up for grabs. Everybody's got a whole new theory of gravitation. Satterfield's report goes into this a little bit, but in order to get from nuclear mass into macroscopic mass, we have G, capital G, the gravitational constant. I didn't read up on it. Pick up Barry's report and see what he says about that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the firmament would be, there are anomalous redshifts. Some objects close to the Earth have higher redshifts than they ought to have, and that would say there's some local distortion of the vacuum of the space. Yeah. Yeah, Steve?
Yeah. This may not be easy to answer. Does that vary, or you run into any problems in this theory that you can't explain?
Not so far. No, it all holds together, and I think that, did you have a question? Not much. unless you're hung up on the Science Channel or something like that. it has to do with your Christian worldview, and if you have a good, solid relationship with Jesus, then you're not intimidated by science and philosophy, and you know that the world is at odds with God. And
would the sin of man take the weight of the earth?
The sin of man does a lot of damage to the creation.
The weight of the universe?
No, apparently not.
Is Christ bearing the weight of the universe?
Yeah. Colossians, in Christ all things are held together.
I think one net that helps me is to realize the assumption that modern science makes, and that's a big point of Philip Jones.
Yeah, that's really...
Everybody has presuppositions.
What are your presuppositions? And if there's anything that you get out of this Genesis study, I would like you to have confidence that Genesis is as much an authoritative part of the Word as anything else in the whole Bible. And you can anchor your life in Genesis and learn from it and apply it to your life. And it's been greatly neglected by the church for a long time. We got to quit because you have to go here.